We're going to hear from the Gospel according to John this morning, but before we do that, I want to take a moment to go over what we just heard. What Doug read for us came from the book of Ezekiel, one of the Old Testament prophets. Ezekiel spoke specifically to the people of Judah, exiled to Babylon after the overthrow of the southern kingdom and destruction of the first temple in 586 BCE. You see, Ezekiel was a priest, and he was captured and carried off as a prisoner during the first attack by Babylon on the city of Jerusalem, before the kingdom fell. This book starts 5 years later, as he sits on a hill overlooking an irrigation canal in Babylon. Ezekiel spends no small amount of time telling the people what went wrong. In this chapter, he indicts his own colleagues and bosses, the priests and the kings, who were meant to be shepherds, but instead exploited the very people they were meant to feed, protect, and defend. But this passage comes toward the end of the book, when Ezekiel gets into the, okay, now what, part of God's message for this beleaguered and now exiled people. Here, God promises that this is not the end of their story, that there will come a day when all of creation is renewed, when God's scattered people are brought together, when justice and righteousness reign. Out of humanity's failure comes God's great hope. God promises that one day God will be the shepherd who leads the people. In the Gospel of John, we're picking up in chapter 10. It's important to know that just before this, in chapter 9, is the story we heard a few weeks ago, where Jesus encounters a man who was born blind. After a conversation with his disciples about whose fault it was that this man was born blind, Jesus uses his spit to make mud on the ground, rubs it on the man's eyes, and tells him to go and wash. He does it, and suddenly he can see for the very first time. There's a big hullabaloo when everyone finds out, not because they're so overjoyed, but because local politics. You see, Jesus did this on the Sabbath. Everyone agrees that he's obviously very powerful, but at the end of the chapter, the religious leaders are arguing amongst themselves about where his great power comes from. Is he from God? If he is, then why is he breaking God's commandments about working on the Sabbath? How could power like this come from the devil or from some other evil force? And that is where we pick up the story. This is John chapter 10, verses 1 through 14. Very truly, I tell you, Pharisees, anyone who does not enter the sheep pen by the gate, but climbs in by some other way, is a thief and a robber. The one who enters by the gate is the shepherd of the sheep. The gatekeeper opens the gate for him, and the sheep listen to his voice. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he has brought out all his own, he goes on ahead of them. And his sheep follow him because they know his voice. But they will never follow a stranger. In fact, they will run away from him because they do not recognize a stranger's voice. Jesus used this figure of speech, but the Pharisees did not understand what he was telling them. Therefore, Jesus said again, "Very truly, I tell you, I am the gate for the sheep. All who have come before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep have not listened to them. I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. They will come in and go out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. The hired hand is not the shepherd and does not own the sheep. So when he sees the wolf coming, he abandons the sheep and runs away. Then the wolf attacks the flock and scatters it. The man runs away because he is a hired hand and cares nothing for the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep, and my sheep know me. The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Bad shepherds, good shepherd. Hired hands, good shepherd. Gate, thieves, robbers. These two passages give us a whole lot of metaphor, right? Sometimes overlapping, comparing and contrasting, sometimes wandering off into left field a little bit. But the core of both passages is this. The people of God do not exist solely to make their leaders' lives better. In fact, the leaders are the ones meant to sacrifice their comfort, their security, and even their lives for the good of the people. Jesus had a huge variety of metaphors available to him in the ancient world. Kings, emperors, military generals, priests, house managers, people who take charge, who give orders, who get things done. But when Jesus wants to talk about the power of God, Jesus says, "I am the good shepherd." An emperor exists solely to be obeyed without question, to be served, to be made comfortable. A queen might be concerned with the welfare of her citizens, or she might not, and no one can make her do otherwise. A shepherd, on the other hand, spends 99.9% of their time concerned with the well-being of the sheep. That is the whole point of a shepherd. The role of the shepherd is to protect the sheep from predators, to guide them to food and water, to make sure they don't injure themselves or get stuck, as sheep are prone to do. The bad shepherds in Ezekiel failed to do this, and instead slaughtered the lambs for their dinner, kept all the best milk and wool for themselves, and outright ignored the sheep who wandered off or needed help. So you'll notice that Jesus doesn't just say, "I am the shepherd." He says, "I am the good shepherd." This is also where the gate metaphor comes in. It's like a little Easter egg for those of us who come later to find, because it likely didn't make a ton of sense in the moment. But Jesus says, "I am the gate for the sheep, and anyone who comes into the pasture any other way is a thief and a robber." Think of it this way. If someone knocks on your front door, it could be anyone with any kind of intentions. You may answer the door, you might ignore them. They may or may not be invited in. But if someone breaks your window and climbs into your house at 2 a.m., you are going to assume it's not a friend coming over for dinner or the internet company there to reset your router. Jesus is the gate. Anyone else coming around saying, "Hey, God sent me to fill in the blank," without showing the fruits of the life, love, and care of Jesus is probably lying. "Many, so many will come in my name," says Jesus. But you have to test them before you follow them. How many of us have heard of the science behind the alpha male in wolves and wolf packs? Who's heard that? Pretty much everybody. All right. So, in 1970, a researcher named David Meck published a book on wolf biology that became a central text for biologists and scientists of all kinds. In order to get the data about wolf behavior for that book, he and others studied a group of wolves in captivity, a large pack stuck together in a limited space. What they found was that the males would fight one another for dominance, and eventually one would come out on top as the alpha male of the pack. The alpha got the best mates, the best food, controlled the rest of the pack. The rest of the males were betas, who would fall in line and take whatever was left over. This became the narrative for how wolf packs operate. And eventually, the language and frameworks spread into the dog world, and unfortunately, also spread into the world of human relationships as well. There are, unfortunately, millions of people around the world unironically calling themselves alphas and using beta as an insult. But that's not the end of the story. For two decades after that book was published, Meck and his colleagues then studied wolf packs in the wild, and what they found there was very different. In the wild, you see, wolf packs are much smaller. They consist essentially of a nuclear family of wolves. You have dad wolf and mom wolf and their children who stay with them for a couple years before going off on their own. Like human families, in wolf packs, mom and dad are the ones running the show. But there is no fighting for dominance. There is no alpha or beta male. There is no pecking order, except for the fact that the younger pups generally eat first. Meck discovered that he was wrong about wolves, and he has spent the last several decades retracting his research, publishing corrections, and trying to get the word out that he was wrong. In 2022, just 4 years ago, he finally got the publisher to take the original book out of print. As it turns out, the behavior that he observed in captive wolf packs was unique to those circumstances, where a bunch of unrelated wolves were shoved together with limited space and limited resources. Meck eventually said it was more like the structure of a prison population than any kind of inborn trait or natural behavior. So the alpha wolf is a myth. But why did it catch on so quickly and so completely? I believe that it's because we humans have been marinating in violent power struggles for so long that when we saw one book that said this is just a fundamental part of the natural world, we all went, yep, absolutely, makes sense, let's run with it. Meanwhile, Jesus, God made flesh, when he needs a metaphor that will capture his relationship to God and God's people, he does not reach for an image of dominance or power or influence. He reaches for the image of a shepherd, the one who nurtures and protects. He says, I am the good shepherd. Not even, I'm like a shepherd. I am the good shepherd. We have plenty of examples of bad shepherds from Ezekiel all the way down the list. It is a long list. But we also have an abundance of examples of Christ, our good shepherd, and those who follow him, binding up wounds and seeking the lost and feeding the sheep, to remind us that we are safe in his pastures. You're probably wondering how I've talked this long about the Good Shepherd, said those two words so many times, without bringing up Psalm 23. Don't worry, we've arrived. As noted earlier, there is a bookmark in your bulletin with two versions of Psalm 23 on it. There's the King James Version, which I know is familiar to many of us. It's the one that most of us memorized as kids. And there's the New International Version on the other side with some updated language. I want to invite you to put this bookmark in your spiritual emergency kit. Leave it somewhere that you're likely to find it when you need a reminder that you are loved, that you are held in God's hands, that you are safe in Christ's pasture. For today, I want to invite us to read it aloud together, to meditate on Jesus' loving care. We're going to read the New International Version side. The Lord is my shepherd. I lack nothing. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He refreshes my soul. He guides me along the right paths for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely your goodness and love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Thanks be to God. Amen.